Welcome to the Berkeley SCEDEC podcast. SCEDEC is a top global accelerator and home to over 300 startups a year. We're a program of UC Berkeley, and our mission is to help startups achieve exceptional growth and connect them with top talent, advisors, and investors from Silicon Valley. In each podcast, we cover different topics in the tech and startup world.
Hello, everyone. I am Caroline Winnett. I am the executive director at Berkeley SCEDEC. I am absolutely thrilled today to welcome our guest. In today's episode, we're going to talk about storytelling for founders, how to do it, what is it? And I have an absolute guru, an expert on storytelling for founders and startups, the author, David Riemer, of Get Your Startup Story Straight, the definitive storytelling framework for innovators and entrepreneurs. David has been doing this for decades, helping founders tell stories. He is a longtime advisor at SCEDEC. He leads our practice area in storytelling. And his career has focused on how to tell stories, and not just for founders, but in performance. He's also currently the board chair of the trustees of the American Conservatory Theater. He's a lecturer at the Haas School, and he's just an all-around amazing guy. Welcome, David.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on the SCEDEC pod.
Okay, David, let's start with a bang. The best SCEDEC pitch opening line. Go.
My parents are deaf. My sister is deaf. That was the opening line of Thibaut Duchemin's presentation on his company Ava, which at the time was called Transcense, as you might remember. And he went on to say, I know how hard it is to understand a conversation that's going on, a group conversation, when you can't hear well. He says you look over here and you see someone speaking, but when someone speaks on the other side of the room, you miss what they say, even if you can read lips. And that's the opening of his presentation. And what he's done so brilliantly is he's grabbed your attention. He's intrigued you to know what it must be like to grow up in that kind of family. And he's introduced the protagonist in the story, his customer, and he's started to define the problem. And all of that in the first 10 or 15 seconds. And at that point, you're hooked and you're ready to go and follow him on the rest of the journey. That's my favorite opening.
I remember that pitch. It is very memorable of all the SCEDEC pitches. I do remember that.
One of the reasons you remember that, Caroline, is because it strikes a chord. It's emotional. You're thinking, wow, that must have been an extraordinary experience that he must have had. And you start to imagine, what would it be like if I had that experience? And what was it like for him? And what was it like for his family? And what would it be like to be in that kind of conversation? And instantly, you've been put in the shoes of the customer he's there to serve in an emotional way.
Right, right. So, you're imagining, what would it be like? And that you get into the story.
Yeah. And your goal as the storyteller, as a founder, is to, as quickly as possible, have your audience imagine that they're the person that you're setting out to solve a problem for. And if you can do that, then they're, by the end of your presentation, they're going to be rooting for you to solve this problem because they're going to feel like it's their problem.
Right, right. Great point. So you've been working with startup founders now for many, many years. And so you decided to write the book in addition to all the coaching you do. Why a book?
Well, I think the biggest reason was that I wanted to try and scale what I do. I mean, what do we teach at SCEDEC? How do you scale this business? And there's only so many workshops I can teach, even in a virtual world, which I've been doing for the last several years. There are only so many people you can coach. But I wanted to be able to bring some of these ideas to a broader audience. And for years, people have been asking me, is there a really great resource on this for innovators? There wasn't. And I realized, knowing a little bit about the innovation space, there's an opportunity here. I might as well fill it myself.
Very good. So give us a quick overview of the book. So I'm a startup founder. What am I going to find in your great book?
So the first part of the book basically teaches you what the framework of a story is. I lead with the notion that you can't tell a great story if you don't have a great story to tell. You have to start with a great story. And to do that, you have to make sure you actually have a great story as a founder. So you need to sort of think about the structural framework of that narrative, build it, and that's section one of the book. That's also a very strategic part of the process, which hopefully we'll get to in this conversation. The second part of the book gives you all the storytelling techniques you need to make that story interesting and memorable and compelling and emotional and logical and clear, which are all the different aspects to a good story. And there are many techniques you can use to do that. So in the second section, I teach that. And in the third section, I talk about some frameworks of the kinds of archetypes for stories. You know, there's the notion, you've heard the argument that there's only seven stories, right? And then there's a million different versions of that. There's only 12 stories. There's only four stories. Doesn't matter. The point is there are certain story archetypes that we recognize. And as someone who's been doing this now for a long time, I've recognized a certain number of story archetypes for founders. And in that third section, I talk about those so that founders can say, oh, that sort of promised land journey story sounds a little bit like what I'm working on. Maybe I'll look at some of these promised land stories and see if any of them give me any ideas about my about what I'm trying to convey about my story. So that's the third section.
Super practical advice. You know, I always enjoyed how you talk about how the product is the hero. And when I first heard you say that all those years ago, it really struck a chord. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's interesting. When you bring that up, I think of all the sessions that you and I have done together coaching teams where they haven't really made the product heroic and they haven't found a way to help the audience actually understand what the product is. But the idea of the product being the hero, it can only be heroic if I know how it's coming in to save the day. And I can't do that if I start by describing the product. I have to start by describing the protagonist in the story, your ultimate customer, get to understand what their life is like, understand what their challenges are, and then specifically what their challenges are as it relates to the thing I'm trying to solve. And then I have to be clear about what the problem is I'm setting out to solve. And it's only after I've set that up that I can bring the product in and it can be the hero.
Right. You have to care about the problem to care about the solution. And I like your phrase, you need to romance the problem, you know, really get people excited about it, upset about it, engaged with it, connected to it.
Yeah. You want them, as we were talking about in the story about Tebow, you want them to feel the problem. You want them to not just intellectually get the problem. You want them to feel the problem. And one of the ways we romance a problem is by trying to tap into what the customer is feeling, not only what functionally they want to accomplish, but what are they emotionally trying to accomplish? You know, what's that deeper thing that they're setting out to try and do that's really kind of driving them crazy? And you can find those in a consumer product, in a B2B product. There's always some emotional driver that we're looking for. And if we can find that, it's much easier to romance the problem because we can get at that real angst.
Right. And you and I have talked a lot about in our various discussions the fact that the brain only remembers because of two things. Either what they're experiencing is emotionally engaging or repeated over and over. So in a pitch, you're not repeating over and over. That doesn't happen. So you've got to engage them emotionally, and you work a lot with founders to kind of adopt that and be okay with that. Like, I have this great startup, and it's very scientific. But yes, if you want to get through to your investor or your customer, your audience, you must engage them emotionally.
Yeah, because there's a connection, as you know. I mean, this is your field, right? There's a connection between the emotional center of your brain and the part where memory lives. And there are studies that have suggested that you're up to 22 times more likely to remember something if you hear about it in the context of a narrative which grabs you emotionally. And that's just the way the brain works.
Right.
So as a founder, if you're not leveraging that sort of, that fact of how our brain functions, you're leaving so much on the table. And it's interesting, as I think back on all the teams we've coached, it tends to be the last thing we get to because we first have to make sure their story makes sense and that we have romanced the problem, we have set up the problem, and that it's clear about how they solve the problem. And then that final layer that we work on is, well, how can we make this story more emotional so it's more memorable? And like Ava was done, what, 7-8 years ago that Tebow was in the program? But you remember that pitch of the hundreds you've seen.
I do.
Because he did such a good job of tapping into emotion.
I do. And he brought his own emotion to that pitch because it was so personally meaningful to him. And so a lot of what we talk about and what you talk about is how do you bring your personal emotion to your pitch? And it can be because you're solving your own problem, as for Tebow and his deaf family, or it could just be a problem that you deeply care about.
Yeah.
But how do you get founders to go from here's my emotion to actually presenting it?
Well, the first step is just for them to understand and believe that putting themselves into the story is extraordinarily powerful. And you know, when I teach, I show examples of people who've done that well. It's really easy if you are the customer. In Tebow's case, it was actually his family who was the customer. He wasn't the customer, but it was a very emotional story for him because he was serving his family. We're not always building a product that's for us or for our family. So how do we get into that emotional turn if that's the case? And it's often from telling the story of a customer you met. Most of the stories I tell in the book are when I introduce myself into the story, I'm talking about someone that I've worked with. And I remember those moments of having the conversations, and I remember working with them to try and find the heart of the story. So a founder can often say, let me tell you about this customer I had. I'll never forget the lunch I had with so-and-so. In fact, one of my favorite illustrations of that is I had a student named Komal Ahmad come into my office hours one day at Berkeley. And this goes all the way back to like 2010 or 12. And she said, I want to solve the world's dumbest problem. I was like, wow, what is that? And she said, it's hunger. Even in a place like Berkeley, she says, I've seen the hunger problem like right in front of me in Berkeley. And then when she describes the problem, she says, I want to tell you about an experience I had meeting a homeless person on Telegraph Avenue after I had just come from the cafeteria where there was all this food that I knew was going to go to waste. And I walk out on the street, I started talking to this homeless man who was a veteran, and he told me that he hadn't eaten in 3 days. So in her telling the story, she's getting very emotional about telling the story. She wasn't the homeless person. She wasn't the person who went hungry. But she met that person and she talked about that. She did another really clever thing, and I saw her do this at the UN. She spoke at the UN because people were so compelled by what she created. And she talked about the fact that during Ramadan, which she celebrates, she knows she's going to be hungry for the day. But in the evening, she knows she's going to have a chance to eat again. So she's now introducing her own experience with something that where hunger is involved to just, again, try and bring herself into the story. Because when you do that, your eyes start to sparkle and the audience can hear it and they start to feel what you're feeling. And then you're starting to win because you've achieved this objective of having the audience feel something.
Right, exactly. And I remember you talking about that story as well. So, you know, I thought it'd be interesting to talk about stories and narratives. Define those two, and how do you talk to founders about that?
So it's kind of the same thing, but the way I use the term narrative is that's structure for me, narrative structure. So, you know, what are the elements you have to have in the part of your pitch which is about the product story? And even though I talk about the whole pitch and we coach teams on the whole pitch, my focus is on the front part of the pitch, which is the product story. And that is the core part of the narrative. And let me describe what that means. So the narrative includes who's the protagonist in the story, who's the customer. What do we know about the customer? What are both the functional and emotional needs that we think we have to solve for them? What specific problem have we set out to solve? What's the conflict in the story? Every story has some intention that some character wants, and then there's some obstacle standing in their way. And this is the first part of the story. In fact, Aaron Sorkin, who's the great screenwriter who wrote A Few Good Men and West Wing and many other, he also wrote The Social Network. He talks about intentional and obstacle being the drive shaft for drama. So the front part of our story is customer, insights about the customer and the conflict, the problem we're solving. And now we've set up the story. Now we want to know how it's going to end. Then we talk about the value proposition, which is a way of framing the benefit that the customer is going to enjoy. And it's only after that that we describe the product. And that's where we try and make the product the hero. We try and describe the product succinctly in just a few points so someone could walk away and describe it to someone else. And as a check at the end, I always want to make sure that they've solved the problem in a way that's different and better than what another product might do to solve the same problem. Because anybody listening to the story is going to start thinking, well, isn't there something else that solves that problem? Why do I need this new thing? Why do I need Uber if there's this thing called a taxi that is like, okay, I don't love it, but it's okay.
Right, right.
So I have to make sure when I'm telling that story, I'm differentiating enough so I know why this is better than that alternative in that example, the taxi.
Right.
So those six elements form the framework for the story. And once we build that narrative, we can then do the other things we do in the pitch, which is what kind of market traction you have, what is your business model, how big is the market, who's your team, et cetera. So that's narrative. The storytelling part is where we say, okay, we have the framework for telling the story. Now, how can I do it in a way that's evocative and emotional? And if you have the right framework, it's a lot easier to do.
Right.
For example, if you've identified that emotional insight, you could say, okay, how can I bring that emotional insight into the story? Mm-hmm. And off we go. And then there's all sorts of techniques that help us tell those compelling stories.
Which are in your book and incredibly practical. So it's not just coming up with a story, but how do you tell it? How do you execute it? What do the slides look like? Because people are usually presenting with slides, and we talk a lot about in our demo day pitch coaching, if there's something on the slide that's either not consistent with your story, not supporting your story, or confusing, off it goes.
Yeah.
It's out of the slide.
And one of the things that I like to say, and I know you reinforce this, or you say it and I reinforce it in these sessions, is the slide should just reinforce visually what you're saying. And to the degree that there's dissonance between what someone's looking at and what you're saying, is you're working against yourself.
Right.
And your audience doesn't have a whole lot of time to try and parse those things. They're not sitting at home reading your slides or pausing it and going back. There, it's all happening at once. Mm-hmm. So I like to think of slides as props. We talked about my theater experience, right? And when I teach, I use a slide as a prop, and there's very, very few words on the slide because I want people listening to me, and I want this slide to just reinforce and enhance what I'm saying.
Right. Great way to put it, a prop. Yeah, an illustration or a prop, for
yeah.
sure.
And if it's a big graphic illustration, I can consume it. If there's five different images on the slide, you know, you're the one in the meetings, Caroline, always saying, get rid of that one, get
right.
rid of that, get rid of that.
Right,
we
right.
need like one thing that I'm processing because I'm trying to look at the image. I'm listening to what you're saying. And in some cases, in many cases, I'm reading some words you've put on the slide. So if there's a very different experience than if I'm sending something to someone in the mail. That's
right.
a different presentation. That's a different format.
Right.
It's the difference between a book and a movie, for example. Dramatically different in terms of right. how that content is presented.
Right. And we talked to founders about their various pitch decks you must have. There's the investor pitch deck. There's the short form investor, the long form. There's the due diligence deck. There's the customer deck. And the demo day pitch deck, which at Skydeck is 5 minutes, that is a completely unusual animal because it has to be, as you just said, someone's looking at slides and listening to you, and it's all just lovely for the brain. I'm not struggling. I'm not trying to figure out what's on the slide and what are you saying. And you're keeping the brain in, you know, system one, right, which is a system of, I'm just really enjoying taking in this information, and I'm following it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the part of this that I find a lot of founders often struggle with is they want to say, so I need a different story for each of these, right, is the question they'll ask. And they just assume that's what they need to do. And I always tell them, nope, it's one core story that you then evolve and tweak and pivot on a little bit as you're presenting to someone different and as you have more time.
Right.
But the story is the same.
Right.
There's that core narrative that we talked about that's at the root of any one of those different formats that you talked about. There may be, for example, if you're meeting with an investor, they may be more interested, well, do you have you protected your IP? How long is it going to take to get this to market? Talk to me a little bit about how you think you're going to make money, those kinds of things. A customer might have some other things they're interested in. Tell me more about how it works, and is it easy to get onboarded with this thing or whatever that customer might be interested in. But those parts of the story only follow that core narrative,
right.
which is the same for anyone.
Right. And then your whole team understands that. Everybody understands that. You're all singing the same song, and everybody knows this is the problem we're solving, and this is why it's important.
Yeah. There's a great video that I share sometimes of Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter and Square, co-founder of Twitter and Square, who's talking about, he says, data is important and all that is important. But what I found is the most critical aspect of me building great products is being a better storyteller. He says, we write user narratives, and the goal of the narrative is to, for example, someone's walking down the street in Chicago, and they walk up to this stand that's selling something, and I want to know what that person's life is like. He said, it literally reads like a play. And then he goes on to say, once we have those narratives and they're clear-cut and defined, everybody on the team from, he says, the business side of the house, sales and selling, the engineers, the product people, the project managers, everybody, the same movie is playing in all of their heads, or the same play in his using his parlance. And that's incredibly unifying. And again, if we're thinking about all these different formats for telling our story, that core narrative has to be solid and the same, regardless of what we add on to it for whoever the audience is.
That's such an important point, David, that getting the story straight is not just, oh, you'll have a nice pitch to investors, but it's critical for your company's sense of, why am I doing this? Why do I show up? Why do I stay up late coding? You know, why am I making all those cold calls? That it it gives people a reason to come to work for you or invest in you. And so it's so important, not just for pitching, and I want founders to understand that if everybody understands your story and why your product is a great solution to a terrible problem, everybody's in. Everybody's all in.
You just had the word there, which was the why, right? The story gives anybody who might be wondering the why. Why
right.
are we doing this? And there's someone whose life is going to be improved if you do this. So to me, that's sort of point number one in this conversation about narrative and getting the story straight. The second part of this is I firmly believe that building this narrative structure is a strategic tool, meaning we think that this book is all about communications, and it's obviously about communications. It's about helping you convey to someone else what you're doing. But I firmly believe, and I've seen this over and over again, that the more the teams really vet this core narrative, the more likely they are to really settle into what they're doing. And what I mean by that is, as they go through it and they're thinking about who they're solving a problem for, and we've seen this many times, they realize, wait a minute, it's a different customer.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's a different segment I have to focus on. And in doing so, they've literally changed their strategy. And they may actually have to change their product to do a better job of meeting the need of that customer, especially when they think about how that customer is using other alternatives to solve the problem, because maybe those other alternatives are fine to a large degree, and they have to build something better, and it's actually informed how they're developing the product now. And I've seen this happen over and over again. One example is LocalWise. I remember this might even have been before your
no,
time.
No, I remember them. Yeah, Ben
right?
and Maya.
Ben and Maya. So they set out to try and create, in their mind, a Yelp for small business. Their thought was small businesses might have a need for a service like Yelp that's designed to help them vet something they might need for their business. Like, for example, they want a designer to design their website, or they want someone to help them with some, customer relationship management, really, really low scale, like a baker that's trying to stay in touch with their customers, whatever. They went and talked to, and they built that narrative. And we talked about that narrative. When they went out and started talking to small businesses to vet the narrative, it was like a hypothesis that they were testing, like scientists. Here's the story that we think we want to tell. We think this is a big issue for you. And they heard over and over again from these customers, you know what? You know what I really hate? You know what drives me crazy? And Maya and Ben said, what? And they said, hiring. We use Craigslist, and Craigslist is horrible. It sucks. It's really terrible. For local hiring. And then they would go on for like 20 minutes talking about what they hated about Craigslist. So Ben and Maya started to say, wait a minute, that's the greatest need. That's a greater need than what I was trying to solve. And they changed their narrative.
Right.
And they set out to solve a different problem, right. which is the problem of making local hiring. And now that's what they are. And they're in cities all over the country. And they're solving this problem for small businesses.
Yeah.
And they built a nice little business.
Yeah.
Different story. And it was in large part because the narrative that they were vetting wasn't the right narrative for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great example. You know, what I really like about how you teach in your book is that there's so many practical things founders can do. And what I love is when you sit down with founders and we'll do some pitch coaching and find out the story's really not baked, right? And so you'll say, put away the PowerPoint slides, take out a pen or a pencil, a piece of paper, or just a blank page in your keyboard, and write the words of your story, words that would take you about 5 minutes to tell. Tell them this is the problem you're solving, this is why it's important. Just write it out. And you did that very early on, I believe, with Databricks, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Early in their inception. And of course now, they've gone on to great heights. But talk about that process a little bit and how founders can do that.
Yeah. So when I sit down with founders like the Databricks founders, which is not a Skydeck company, but a Berkeley company that is now a $38 billion value, has a $38 billion valuation, which is extraordinary.
Right.
It started 8 years ago in a little conference room in Berkeley with a couple of PhDs and a professor. Together they created this extraordinary story. We sat down and we just started talking about all these elements of the narrative. I'd say, this was really early on when they were figuring it out. who's the best first target customer for this incredible thing you're building? And for those who don't know, Databricks is a platform. It's a data platform that's built on top of what was originally an open source platform called Apache Spark that was created by one of the three founders. And they decided to add on some features and functionality that they could sell, and that became Databricks. And as we talked about it, they said, look, it's data scientists, especially in super high growth companies, mostly digital companies that rely incredibly heavily on digital transactions where there's so much data that they can learn from. And we honed in on that story. And then we started to ask questions like, well, what's it like being that data scientist? And what we discovered from the conversation was that there was this massive gap between expectations and the ability for the data scientists to fulfill the expectations. This is in 2013 or 14. Companies are starting to spend a fortune on housing data. And then they're hiring all these data scientists. And they say, go find that business insight that's going to let me crush the competition. Go. And the data scientists would go back to their desks with the CEOs and the executives of the company saying, You're the hero. You're the superhero that's going to save the company. And they couldn't do what they needed to do because their arms were tied behind their back. It took so much work to write the programs and to operate the programs that could even begin to access insights from the data that they would come back and the executive would say, what have you discovered? And they're like, well, I'm still trying to build the programs and I'm trying to find resources to check the operations of the program. And to make a long story short, they were extraordinarily frustrated because they knew they could be the superhero, but they didn't have the tools to do it. And so now we set up this emotional issue for a very B2B, high-tech kind of solution that anyone can relate to.
Right.
Right? This idea of massive expectations that you as an employee can't meet. And who can't understand that? And that became the initial core narrative. So all of that happened just by talking about the business, talking about let's get focused on that first customer. Let's really understand them. And then we were able to build a narrative that was a springboard to, I mean, that's not why they're a $38 billion company. It helped early on. Incredible product, incredible execution, wonderful leaders, Ali Goetze, the CEO, and Ion Stoica, the chair, and Matei Zakaria, the guy who invented Spark, are extraordinary human beings, and they built this great company. But it didn't hurt to start with a good story.
Oh, yeah. No, I think you should take some credit for getting them to focus on that. And, you know, what I like about your method is that your process of, you know, who's the protagonist, which is the customer, right, which is the person we're going to care about that we're solving the problem for. And it might be a consumer. It might be someone in a large company. It could be anybody, anywhere. But at the end of the day, there's a person we're solving the problem for in our startup,
yep.
Right? And so make that person real. And I like how your steps answer the questions that everybody, but especially investors, will have. So I, as an investor, I want to know, what's the problem? Why should I care about it, right? Why should anybody care about it? What's your solution? Say it clearly, right? So I understand what you're doing. Don't give me jargon and you know, fluffy words. Tell me what you're making. Why is it better than everybody else in the competition, right? And why can you execute this plan? And why are you going to give me confidence? And your whole process covers all of those elements beautifully so that the end of the 5 minutes or the 20 minutes or ever have how long you have, the person is going, I want another meeting.
Yeah, which is the goal.
I want to learn more,
it's
right?
It's the goal.
Yeah.
And it all starts with a simple premise that there is a human being who has some issue that you're going to help them with. A human being. Whenever someone starts a presentation by saying, my customer is a Fortune 500 company, I'm like, no. Fortune 500 companies are unable to buy products.
Right.
They don't. I mean, there may be a world in the future through AI where companies automatically buy products. But even then, someone wrote the code which
right.
told them to buy the product at this time. The fact
right.
is, people in companies buy products. And to me, the most powerful part, the main reason why it's useful for someone to get the book is it forces them, and this whole process forces them, to ground their story in the customer and think about their customer as a person, whatever they're working on. And
right.
if they do that, the lights start to go on for them. I can't tell you how many times, Caroline, I've met with a team and we started the conversation this way. And they start with, my customer is a Fortune 500 company. And I'm like, no, who in that company? Well, what do you mean? Well, who's using the product? Who's buying the product? I want to know what their experience is like. Well, I don't know. Well, go find out. Right. Talk to those customers. And it's a process that forces people to really dig into those things, which you and I both know is essential to, first of all, building a great product and then convincing people it's something worth investing in.
Right. Right, right. Let's talk a bit about clarity, because when we're pitch coaching, that almost always comes up. It's rare that someone gives a pitch and it's like, oh, it's completely clear. How do you get a founder to just hone in on just the necessary information?
A couple of things come to mind. One is, if they think about the way a story is structured, and they think about the fact that a good story starts with you meeting someone and you're watching them go through something and you figure out there's some obstacle in the story, and then by the end of the story, it's solved in some way. They may not have gotten what they wanted, but at least there's some arc to the story. If people think about that at its core, they now need to think, does my presentation do that? Have I set something up in a compelling way? Does the audience understand what the issues are clearly enough so that I can then go solve it? And then when I solve it, does the way I describe the product answer the questions that I raised in the first part of the presentation? So the first thing on clarity is the logic there. The second thing is, in describing the product, have you come up with a way of talking about it? I talk about the rule of three, right? What are three things you could say about how the product works which would let me walk away and go, okay, I get how this works? So one example that I use is, there's a company called ShotSpotter, which is based in the South Bay. And it's a solution that lets cities that have gun violence problems respond faster to gunshots. And when you describe what the product is, they have a very simple product descriptor, which is something to the effect of a gunshot detection solution, easy for me to say. And then when they describe it, they say, here's how you should think about how the product works. There are sensors that are put up on buildings or light poles that detect the sounds. There's then a very robust platform using artificial intelligence and algorithms to determine whether those were actual gunshots or was it backfiring or fireworks or something else. And then we have a human layer where the humans come in and vet it and make sure what it was and identify the ballistics and how many shots, et cetera. And that says exactly where it happened, because they can triangulate it based on all these different sensors. And then the third thing is an app that this goes to, so the public safety people can come, the police can come in and address it. So hardware, software, and then a notification app. You could walk out of this room and describe how ShotSpotter works.
Perfectly clear.
Right?
Yeah.
So what's that rule of three? How do I simply describe a product so someone hearing it can walk away and tell the person in their office that they want to get excited about that pitch they just saw?
Right.
Oh, it's great. Here's how the product works.
Right.
Any more than three things, they usually lose track.
Exactly. Yeah. Keep it short and simple, and easy to relate. So a good way to test your story is take somebody who's never heard anything about your company, tell them what you do in 30 seconds, and ask them to repeat it back. And if they can't, go back to the drawing board.
Yeah.
It should be very, very, very clear.
I often tell them, find an 8-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Good idea.
If you can find someone who is just a young person, it doesn't have to be an 8-year-old, but, you know, that just to make the point, and see if they can play it back to you and see if it made sense to them. Because, and even for complicated products, if I could tell that Databricks story to a young person and say, imagine these people who their bosses expect them to do all these great things, and then when they go back to do the work at their desk, it's really hard. And they can't do what they were asked to do. That 8-year-old could walk away and describe
Absolutely.
That to somebody else.
Absolutely. And relate to it, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure. And we also talk a lot about metaphors. So especially for deeply technical companies or life science companies who are creating something that's highly scientific and you have to be able to explain it to everybody, we talk a lot about metaphors. And one of the ones that I remember and I talk about a lot is a company called Chameleon Biosciences, who made a gene therapy. And the science behind it is incredibly complex. The founder, Janine Winslow, worked in the lab of Jim Allison, who's a Nobel Prize winner from Berkeley. I mean, this is deep tech science, right? But the way she presented it was so clear. She called the company Chameleon, which, you know, what does chameleons do? They camouflage. And her gene therapy, she called the evader. And then she had a nice slide where here's a molecule with like a camouflage around it. And basically what it did, and I still remember this after all these years, was that her technology camouflaged the gene therapy so it could go into the patient and not get attacked by the immune system. And so that was able to deliver that to children and people, multiple dosing. And it was because of that metaphor of the disguised, you know, camouflaged molecule, and it worked brilliantly.
Yeah. And there's a whole nother thing at play there, which is language. So metaphors are fantastic. I want to give one example, one of my favorite examples too, in a minute. But I love the way she came up with the language evader, which now that's a very evocative term. And
right.
I'm literally imagining evading something, right?
Right.
Everything about what she did, the brand name is also something that conveys something that's very evocative. So a lot of times finding just the right language in your storytelling can be the thing that unlocks the whole story. And that word evader's brilliant.
Right.
If I had been sitting there when she was telling that story, and I actually now remember that I was, I probably said, yeah, make sure you use that word every time.
Right.
One of my favorite metaphors was for the product, the Rodimatic, which you know I love and talk about, which was created by an Indian expat engineer, a woman who was living in Singapore. And she wanted to create something for people like her who was working full time and didn't have the time to cook and do things in the kitchen, but wanted to have some of those things she grew up with. They were much harder to find living outside of India, living in Singapore. And she built this thing that makes rotis. And when she pitched it, many of the people who she pitched it to, this goes back 10 or 12 years, they didn't even know what a roti was. And she described it and everything else. But she said, I would love for this to be in Indian communities like the rice cooker is in other communities where rice is an essential part of a meal. And suddenly everyone in the room was like, oh, I get it.
Right.
Right. It was such a clear – they knew people who had rice cookers.
Right.
And they knew it was culturally a really right. important part of the culture. And so that was that thing that made it immediately come to mind. So anyway, metaphors, language, these are all – you know, the book is a guidebook. And as you said, there's a bunch of tips and techniques. It just literally gives you suggestions of things to explore. These are a couple of examples. Get the right language and make sure you have a strong metaphor if it fits your product.
Right, right. Something people can relate to. And it's completely fine to say we're X for Y. If that makes sense for your product, we're something for something where the Y is something we all relate to, a big company.
Yeah.
Founders do ask us, should we say that? Absolutely, if it makes it really clear and people can relate to it.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things that came out of writing this book was one of our founders, one of our Skydeck founders, Steve Derrico. You remember Steve?
Yeah.
Who's building, is it Dottie?
I think. Yes.
Dottie,
mm-hmm.
which is a product and a service to help people who are undergoing cancer treatments to manage their cancer care, or caregivers to help them manage the care. And Steve asked me after, he was one of the readers of the book when it was coming out, and Steve said, well, when people aren't – you're great at picking this stuff up when we have these meetings, David, but how does someone discover that real gem when they don't have you sitting in the room with them? And I said, well, you know, read the book. That'll help. But secondly, the key thing is to try and find that thing that has some emotional resonance that's going to really land with someone. And I said, your company is a great example in our conversation of that. You talked about the fact at one point, you were just listing a bunch of things, and you said, having cancer is like having a second full-time job. And when you said that, I just stopped. And I was like, wow, that's incredibly powerful. That hit me in the gut. Because I know having one full-time job is plenty, thank you very much. And if I have to have two, or I can't work, and my whole job is managing my cancer – that's just a powerful statement.
Right, that everyone can relate to.
But everyone can relate to. And I said, so look for that thing when you're telling your story to people and see what resonates with them. And in my case, I literally stopped you. And he said from that point forward, he actually started using that in every pitch. He said it transformed his whole pitch in his company, the ability to sort of land on that one simple statement. So that's both language, but it's also that emotional thing. And if I'm not in the room, or Caroline, you're not in the room to help them discover it, they should look to the people they're presenting to and see what gets them to lean forward, what gets them to say wow or gasp or something. And then you'll know you've landed on something.
Right.
Or just look for the thing in your story that, as you said, anyone can relate to that's really emotional. So those are the ways I encourage people on their own to try and find that nugget.
Right. Well, let's finish up by focusing on that a bit. You know, we started out with the emotional engagement, and we're back to it because it's so critical. And I think founders sometimes aren't quite sure if it's, you know, will I be credible and scientific if I'm being emotional? And we definitely want to disabuse you of that because we always like to point to, you know, great legends. Steve Jobs, when he got up on stage, what was he doing? He was grabbing the audience by the heart, you know, making them care about those products. And so it's just key, and it's a way to get your great product out in the market so people buy it and use it.
Yeah. I mean, great leaders throughout history have been great at this. The best leaders are great storytellers. And at the end of the day, not only do you have to get investors behind you, but you've got to get others behind. You've got to get partners behind you. You've got to get employees. You've got to convince employees' partners that they should join your company. There's a lot of different things, customers and et cetera, et cetera. And storytelling is a great way of doing that. And yet we start with many people who say, well, it's not appropriate, as you said, in a business meeting. Or culturally, we don't do that in our culture. I've heard a few people say that's not the way we do it
right.
in Germany, for example.
Right,
you know,
right,
it's
right.
like, well, there are, people tell stories all over the world. And it's just this human thing. And it's something that, as I said earlier in this conversation, it's just the way our brain works, that we're going to be more likely to respond to something if it's delivered in the context of a narrative where there's some emotional tug. We're more likely to remember it, and we're more likely going to want you to solve the problem. One of my favorite illustrations of this was the story of Surbi Sarna, who was a founder who also went to Berkeley undergrad and created a solution or is in the process of building a solution for women who have ovarian cancer scares. It's very hard to detect, and very invasive surgery to try and figure out if that's something that's going on with a young woman. And she had a personal experience with it, and she never told the story. And one day, she was meeting with Tim Draper, who was having a conversation with her, not unlike the ones we have, where he's asking her to tell her story. And he finally just said, well, why did you choose this particular form of science to study? And she finally relented and told the story of being a 13-year-old and actually passing out in her room while she was writing a paper on Emerson because she was having a complication due to the scare. And then she was in the hospital and in and out of the hospital for years with her mother because if they went in and did the kind of surgery they needed to do to really understand it, she might have been rendered infertile. It was an incredibly emotional time for her. The point is she never told that story until Tim Draper finally pulled it out of her. And then, of course, she went on to tell that story regularly. He was her first investor. He gave her $4 million. She ultimately sold her company for $250 million to a larger biotech.
Great example. We've been in the room together, David, where we've somehow it's come up. The founder's like, oh, by the way, I had this problem. I had this disease. Cancer, I think, came up at some point. Or my mom had cancer. And we're like, holy smoke. Say that. And sometimes they need a little encouragement because you feel very vulnerable when you're telling your personal story. And I would just say to any founder, you know, should I share that? Absolutely. It will make you look like a founder with courage and a founder with a purpose. And it will make you feel like you're able to tell your story. And we've seen that every time when founders do that, they're like, I'm really glad you had us bring that up.
Yeah, it was life-changing for them in a lot of ways that, first of all, they were able to talk about it and do it in such a way that hopefully they could help others because that's why you're telling the story.
Right.
You know, I just saw Lincoln Nguyen. I don't know if you remember Lincoln from Karuna Labs, who was
yes.
a Skydeck founder.
Yeah.
And he must have come through 5 or 6, 7 years ago. But I just joined them and had coffee last week. They're doing great, by the way.
Oh, good.
Really found a market in building the company nicely. But as we sat down, I told him the story of why he founded the company. Hundreds of pitches you and I have listened
yes.
to just at Skydeck, and I do this all over the place.
Right.
But I literally told him word for word the story of what inspired him to found the company because he told me. And
yeah.
it was so memorable. He
yes.
talked about the fact that his father had had a stroke, actually a couple of strokes, and had severe chronic pain and was basically turned their living room into a rehab center. And he never quite fully recovered from it. And ultimately, he died when Lincoln was 22. And that inspired Lincoln to try and build solutions to help people with chronic pain for whatever reason that they developed the pain. And he built a VR solution to help people use VR. And they now have added coaches who help coach mm-hmm. people through the use of this VR to overcome their chronic pain. So not only is the company doing well, but they're helping all sorts of people like Lincoln's father, mm-hmm. which was his inspiration for building the company.
I remember that. I remember getting that story out of him. And yeah, that was one of those moments. Yeah, great example. Well, to close, any last tips for founders, things maybe they won't hear anywhere else about the story?
No, just believe that will make a difference. Believe that the story will make a difference. And you make the effort to invest time in not only building a version of the story, but constantly evolving the story and looking for that little magical thing that makes the story just go to the next level. I like to tell the story of a Pixar film, Toy Story 4, which many people at Pixar thought was something they shouldn't even do. Because when Toy Story 3 happened, it was sort of the perfect ending to the arc of the story. Andy, the boy, goes off to college, and the toys find another owner. The end, happily ever after, great.
Right.
Perfect arc, three movie trilogy, great. Well, it's such a popular movie, they feel we have to go make a fourth. And they do it, and some people inside thought the story was okay but not great. What they did is they did some polishing at the very end of the film where just the way they animated this wonderful scene where Woody is with Bo Peep, and they just have a moment on the roof. These are animated dolls,
toys. Right.
But the way they animated the look in his eyes, the look in her eyes, and the way there was a hug and the way he put her hand on his shoulder, wiped a tear, there was something that happened. Go watch the movie. It was so incredible. It just landed that story. And that was all that final finesse and polish at the end of the process. They'd had the story. The storyboard said, have Woody and Bo here and have this moment, which seemed good. But when they polished it and every animator added that perfect little thing, it was this magical moment that just made the movie great. And it was like, wow, Toy Story 4 was great too. The point is, our stories can always be evolved. We can always find just that language. I'm sure evader wasn't used the very first time.
It was not.
She pitched that business, but eventually find that word and build things around it. And we can always make our stories better and make them shine and more memorable. And founders should be looking to do that all the time.
Very, very good advice. And advice that we say at Skydeck as well. Thank you, David. Thank you for all you do at Berkeley Skydeck, all the help you provided for our founders. Thanks for being an inspiration to our founders and me as well. I've learned so much working with you. And every time we sit and chat, I learn more and I'm inspired to go create a great story for my organization and help our founders. Tell us how to find your excellent book.
Well, you can find it on Amazon. Obviously, that seems to be where most books are sold nowadays.
Right.
You can also find it in other online channels. And if you're the kind of person who wants to buy it in your local bookstore, you can go to your local bookstore and ask them, and they can buy it, and you can pick it up in your local bookstore.
Great. Old school. All right. Well, thank you. This has been such a wonderful talk with David Reamer, storytelling author, guru, and just an all-around awesome guy. Thanks so much, David.
Thanks, Caroline.
This episode was produced by Sybil Chen. Theme music by Guy Arez and David Ari Leon of Score Songs. We record this podcast on the UC Berkeley campus. Thanks for listening.